Hey, you're listening to The Morning Show with Aaron, and it's time for the Kairongoa segment. Nara Nora Nata's here in the studio. Welcome.
Ai, kia ora. Atamari e te whānau whānui o Whaingaroa and beyond.
And you want to start? Do you want to start off today with the history thing that we were just talking about off the air?
Yeah, we were just talking about how New Zealand history is now being, under the radar as an important part of education that was a huge missing link within the state education system. I can't speak for other systems because they have different ways of approaching that as well, but definitely in what we call the mainstream state education system, there was a huge missing component around learning our own history and preferring to learn what we called world history because that was important. And
English history. Like because we were...
I don't know if it was specifically English history because my own experience, and I've been in many schools of different deciles throughout primary and secondary, but my experience in terms of what they call the social sciences was when I encountered, I was teaching at Howick College for a time there in Auckland, in Tāmaki Makaurau. And my brief was, at this particular time, was to teach to, they were high school students, classroom full of like 30 odd students, and my brief was to actually teach them about the Holocaust. I took exception to that. The resources were extraordinarily confronting. The posters that were on the walls within the classroom were way out of my zone. I mean, we're talking about posters that were put out by the education system of like a pile of children's shoes. Hundreds of them. Yeah. And that was, I didn't know that at the time, but that was taken from a very specific time in history in Europe, and it was the subject matter was called the Holocaust. I promised from that moment on that I had no right to, but I could feel it. I had no right to teach someone else's history who I hadn't participated in or didn't have a background in, but I had all this incredible resources, well, call them incredible, because they were very confronting. And I thought, why are our own New Zealand children of mixed ethnicity studying this? Why this? You know, when we actually don't know very much about the country that you're living in, you know, the country that you eat your breakfast in and you sleep, in Aotearoa, New Zealand. You know nothing about this country. However, here I was walking into a classroom and they were going to get credits for knowing this.
So I said about teaching English history here, and that's part of the English mythology now about how England defeated the evil Nazis. And having spent time in England, like it still goes all through their culture. It's all in their TV shows and always. There was a show when I was 25 years ago. There was a show called The Young Churchill about Churchill as a boy and what a great character he was even then, how much integrity he had and all that. So that is part of the English cultural mythology.
Yeah, and I think it was very deliberate. Yeah, it was a colonising factor that enabled them to gain a lot of ground in terms of, And so social media, a specific part of it also focuses on things like the monarchy, you know, of England. And I find that very confronting because, you know, in England they don't bother with that. They say, oh really? We don't have a public holiday for the King's birthday.
Do they?
Nope.
Are you sure?
Yep.
I thought they did.
Yep. I was told that it's something they don't bother. They don't bother.
But they are very attached to their monarchy over there.
I don't know if they are.
Well, some are some aren't. I think it's actually... But the ones that are very attached.
Yeah, and I think that's because, you know, they still have a lot of money in the coffers from the colonies which they colonised, and they can do that, and they can keep that up on the top of the social media and within those portals where they get exposure, you know, like it's...
So what's missing from the New Zealand history that you would have preferred to have been teaching? I can think of one particular thing that stands out that should have been in every school.
Honestly, as people are writing, as historians are taking up the challenge to write about specific parts of New Zealand's colonising history and pre-European, there are some extremely difficult stories that come forward. I'm involved with one currently around one of our paramount chiefs, Te Pahi, around a medal that was received from Philip Gidley King, as the government of the time was from Paramata, that was pre-treaty. And that story's not good. I mean, not good in the sense that it's really happened, and there are parts of it that have been preserved because of the archival diaries that are kept, and that's, you know, part of the English history is to keep histories, written histories from those times. But they're all over the world, of course. They were held within different universities and
museums.
In museums, and you learn that when you become part of those worlds where you access and you realise, oh my gosh, this Māori had an incredible culture, because here's evidence or the taonga, tuku iho, that are present within the drawers, the bottom drawers of, down in the bowels of museums all over the world. And just that repatriation of some of those taonga is people spending, within the university setting, their whole lives are devoted to the repatriation of taonga back to tribes and iwi. And
European museums are full of indigenous artefacts, should we say.
Yeah.
You're breathing deeply.
Yeah. It's something I came across, my time to learn on a really... really real level. I was in Sydney and we went down with the curator of that particular part. It's called the Pacific and Basin, or the Pacific area of the music where taonga were held from this area. And I was just blown away. He said, yeah, much of it is not even labelled. They haven't got time yet.
They just got so much treasure, booty. They got so much booty.
Yeah, booty is an interesting word. In the English language, I learned about booty from this project, Te Pahi, our paramount chief from the far north. How a booty is like a legal word it's a word that means that, yes, well, you received it from a wartime, a warlike situation, so that's okay.
Ah, okay.
That makes it okay.
Even if you started the war with the express purpose of getting the booty. In fact, that was the purpose of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and the booty was often, well, this is my experience, they actually wrote it in diaries, what they received. So there are very good records of what was actually received from that... What do you call it? Well, when you attack people, you know, like you go in and you take what's not yours from that situation, and then you own it. You own it. You actually have every right to own it, which doesn't make sense to me. And as the years have gone on, I mean, this piece of... this taonga, which is a from Te Pahi, that was gifted to him by Philip Gidley King, 200 years it sat in a vault somewhere, and we still don't know where, but it was sold through Sotheby's, through an auction house.
Oh, okay, that's right. So you talked about that last time. So the people who have put it for sale at Sotheby's are remaining anonymous.
Yeah, they can. Well, it's because Sotheby's lawyers have very cleverly able to, within the legal system, to not reveal that. They don't actually. It's not required because we had top lawyers, the best lawyers in Sydney at that time, working on how the medal could actually be returned to Māori, because it was very clearly given to Te Pahi, and it was taken, we probably could say, during a massacre that the Te Pahi's people suffered on the Te Pahi Islands at the time, and it then went on this incredible journey as we followed through the story through diary writings.
Yeah.
Te Funakin was at the time had come in to govern Aotearoa. He was came under his governorship at that time, and he managed to get hold of it, and then it sort of disappeared and went into the Middle East and travelled, and somehow it's back. It's in the museum, Te Papa, between Te Papa and the Auckland Museum, because it was the first purchase of those two museums.
A joint purchase.
Joint purchase. It was a historical purchase.
So they had to buy it.
We're talking.
You showed me. This is a small medal.
Yeah.
It's, what are we, like 5 centimetres across, maybe?
Forged silver of the time, and it was very clearly belonged to Māori. And the Sotheby's lawyers made comment about, if Māori had some right to it, they should have spoken up.
What, the ones who were dead in the village after the massacre?
I just find that very condescending in itself, and I'll probably reply to that comment in my narration that I'm preparing for the radio for ABC Australia.
Yeah, that's. But people usually don't say that sort of thing out loud anymore. Even if they're thinking it, they know better. But I guess that's in Britain where it's a little different.
Yeah, there's a lot of people coming forward, who are writing historical accounts, recalibrating them. So is it the New Zealand Wars? Is it the Māori Wars? Is it the tribal wars? Just that languaging in itself, has many connotations. And so the Waikato Wars, what's that?
Sometimes I hear the phrase the Land Wars, which I think is what it was really about. I think that's a...
Yeah, there's some more true and accurate...
part of what it was really about,
explanations, but they also... Those words have a variety of meanings, and so harnessing the what was really going on and the kaupapa is a really big part of rewriting our history.
I guess from the Māori perspective at the time, it would be the English Wars. it's like we talk about the Vietnam War, but I'm sure in Vietnam it's called the American War, because it was the Americans who invaded, and their friends like us.
We do have a lot of still oral history held within our people who can speak of a different time, many from, a different time zone that we have passed on through the way that we do in our marae, particularly going to Big Hui and hearing stories and gathering, or not gathering, that's what they're talking and discussing or letting us, giving us information about. And we do hold those things, but more in our minds, and they're not written down. So one I'd like to just refer to, and I have done this earlier in an earlier show, is what was called the Boyd Massacre, which happened in the Whangaroa Harbour. It's a very historical... It's in a very...
Which harbour?
the Whangaroa Harbour in the far north where I'm from.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know that. I know where that is.
Yeah, and it's called a massacre. There was no massacre. That's a convenient word to express an event that Māori came in and, you know, massacred the people of the boy. And it's going to be challenged over and over again until they get it right. It was a situation of Utu, one of the paramount chiefs, whose son, Te Ara, was flogged on the deck by the captain of the Boyd. And, you know, when you have a sense of that rangatiratanga and the chiefs of the time, that was totally inappropriate. And it would have raised a lot of concern of Ngāpuhi chiefs at the time that there had to be utu, a payback, for that occurring. You know, these incidences, they're not just one-off incidences. They happened throughout the colonising history of the English.
I think they're often portrayed as something that just happened out of nowhere because Māori people were, I don't know, I don't want to use any of the words they're going to use because they wouldn't be appropriate to say now, but all the blame would have been put on Māori people for that. And the triggering factor behind it would have been omitted, I presume. That's usually how those things work.
Yeah. It's about what's missing. It's not about what we're told. It's about what's it, the missing story. Yeah. So there's always like his story, her story, and our story. So you've got to mesh many things, elements together to get a more accurate and true account of cultural perception, what was going on at the time, the bigger picture, what were they doing in the Whangaroa Harbour anyway, you know, and they thought they could just, you know, sail in there on the Boyd and, you know, receive the trade that they were there for, which was Kauri. There were mills all around the north where they were milling, not wood, they were milling Kauri, the Kauri out of the forests and decimating, we know. Do we know really the extent of the decimation of native forests? Probably not, because it was quite a brutal undertaking the way they took a Kauri tree out of the forest for the ships, for English ships. They were made into mastheads.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there's some really pillaging of the landscape that happened right from the beginning.
I think from my perspective, there were things that surprised me. I interviewed Katerina Mataira.
Oh, wow.
Katerina Wierangi Mataira. And she's talked about Parehaka. And maybe about 8 years ago this happened. And I'd heard the word, and I knew there was a song that Tim Finn and Herbs did, and I had never paid any attention to the lyrics. I was completely astonished about the story of Parehaka and how that was served as inspiration for Gandhi and then Martin Luther King, like that.
Oh, absolutely. It was the first non-violent resistance in the world, and Gandhi.
And I was just astonished that I didn't know. I was 42 or something, or 43 or 44 when I first learned that story, which should be in all our schools. And going to the Kōkiri Centre and Tex Rickard talking about the history of that piece of land and actually why there was a protest in the 70s and 80s about it. And again, I was completely shocked being alive at the time and hearing adults talking about it in my life and hearing it on the news or seeing it on the news and how somehow through all of that wall-to-wall coverage in the media, somehow I still missed the real story of how the land was misallocated would be the very polite way of saying it.
Yes. There are incredible histories that I look forward to us going forward, and those in our schools and out of our schools, and those who want to learn New Zealand history and how we participate in that learning and sharing of our what we have to contribute to that, to those histories as well, because they're extensive. they're extensive and they're held and they're people, you know, my people, we weep, you know, because we know other parts of the story that New Zealanders don't realise, the great loss that took place through mismanagement and, like, being polite, outright abuse and many stories where our rangatira, women and children, died through different battles that should never have happened.
I mean, we know it was done through, at best, trickery and at worst, outright acts of war by the settler community. So,
absolutely.
In some ways, the settler community, like the average white person, they were also pawns in a game of empire, because the English knew that if they brought enough people out here, that they would become they really would dominate the land.
And they dominated the land in a really selfish way. So I lived in Howick, as I was saying earlier, for a time, and there's a hill in Howick that the Maori history is not. It's called Stockade Hill. And it was where the Maori women and their children actually gathered to hide from the English, who were basically, you know, around trying to kill them. And that Stockade Hill is where Anzac Parade is held every year. So I've been to several on that mountain, and every time the ceremony started, I just felt this unease and thought, no, Maori were hiding from you, and here you are on this maunga, this, and in an extraordinary view. It's the highest point in the Howick village, called Stockade Hill. So the Maori history was diminished, and what the women suffered, the Ngāti people. And here was this great celebration of the sacrifice that was made by both English and, or by many, for Anzac. It's a crime. It's just you can't keep doing that and think it's okay. It's not okay. You know, it's like abuse, historical abuse. It's not okay to let the other history, the truth of what really happened on Stockade Hill, happen to Maori women and children who were running away from being killed.
Yeah, and I know that the people who originally made the decision, it will have become a tradition now, most people wouldn't even know, but the people who originally started that tradition of, this is where we have the Anzac Parade, or this is where we do these sorts of things. It was all about that, invisibilizing the old story. I don't think that's a real word, but you know what I mean.
Well, it is invisible. And the sooner that it's, not the sooner, but the way that it's taught is also important. The imagery that are used, you know, the salvaging of that history so that we feel and know how this nation, this our dual cultural heritage, actually was born, you know, it was given birth to long before the treaty. Maori were entrepreneurial in seeking, once they knew there were English somewhere in the neighbourhood. Te Pahi travelled, you know, it was a 6-week journey on a ship, by ship. It wasn't a plane. You don't hop on a plane and land there in 4 hours in Sydney. To get to Poihakina, which is, you know, the Māori name for Sydney, and to then engage with the colony at the time, the chiefs of the colony. Yeah, we were interested. We have a very entrepreneurial, and it's in our bones. Want to know, who are you, what do you want, and how can we share space together in some very real, practical ways, you know, trading that was happening on the high seas pre-treaty. I didn't mind the treaty, Treaty came up later, and it wasn't written by Māori. We have to keep reminding ourselves the treaty was not written by Māori.
Well, it was from what I've read, it was a strategy. I mean, it's useful for us now. It gives us something to ground the reparations in, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the political sense.
But it was a bit
of
a strategy back then.
Yeah, and I, you know, there's a lot that we can go into regarding the treaty and how it's placed in our communities and how it sits with our hapuri at this time in our history. And there are many stories, and they're confronting. They can be very confronting, but it's necessary for us to grow through these storylines, these histories, so that we heal. Genuine healing takes place.
There are so many stories.
I would
literally say there's probably a million stories about all the little places and the little things in this country. Like Angeline Greensill was in some years ago talking about a piece of land out at Whale Bay, and of course what a lot of Pākehā people don't know, what a lot of people don't know is that the councils were kind of imposed on the country, and then they started charging rates, and the Māori people, if they didn't have any source of income, couldn't pay the rates, and so then they had their land taken off them.
That's a trick, right?
Basically, it's a trick. But Angeline came in and talked about the particular piece of land somewhere out at Whale Bay, and about how they used to invite people to come out. Well, it was a place where people would go swim. I think it's by the lagoon. So people would come out and swim, and they'd charge a little gate charge. And as a little girl, she was one of the ones who sat at the gate and took the coins.
For the colony?
Well, technically to pay the rates. But yeah, but that's how they kept that piece of land.
Oh, that's incredible. There was a clever plan,
of like, we can make use of the pools and sell access to it.
Oh, that's incredible. I mean,
yeah, and that's one little piece of land.
But I tell you,
and it has a story like that, and that's me remembering. So it's probably not very accurate.
Oh no, it sounds pretty on cue, and those stories are incredible stories.
A brief version of that story of that small piece of land, and every piece of land around must have a story like that. And then we've got the story of the medal that you're talking about, the Te Pahi medal.
Yeah, well, the Te Pahi Islands are owned by one of New Zealand's wealthiest people.
Naturally.
Yeah, the islands. Island. I mean, like, yeah. How do you own an island that has historical, such history? You know, like, how did you get hold of it? Like, you know, we still can ask those questions and look back on the records, and then it gets shady. It gets shady because it just does. And nobody there is investigations going on, actually, around many of these stories. But that story about Whale Bay is an important story for us, because we can understand, you know, Whale Bay is a designated area, but it's I've just been there recently for another kaupapa, and honestly, that whenua there is sacred. It's an incredibly sacred area to enter into.
Do you want to talk also about Te Wiki o Te Reo?
I do. Te Wiki o Te Reo Māori. So there's been the dates is we think they are, the 11th of September to the 18th is going to be dedicated to Te Wiki o Te Reo Māori. So I'm really interested in how we're going to navigate that as a community. Honestly, I don't know how I want to put that out there for us, but I really believe we have an opportunity to, here we go, I've got my, you know, wanting to celebrate and to look more closely at how we embrace this cultural heritage through our reo.
So this is Māori Language Week for anyone who's missed the Te Reo version, Te Wiki o Te Reo Māori.
I'm hoping there's progress. We need to make progress, people, whānau, that progress beyond saying kia ora to each other and and, you know, really dedicate some genuine time to becoming bilingual. And many of us are, not myself, but are already trilingual, but Māori is not part of that story yet. And I know there's a big search. People are wanting that for themselves because it's not an economic language. But believe me, if you've got Māori in your in your CV, you're highly what's the word? Desirable to employ. Just saying that for so many reasons, right from our preschoolers, early childhood, right up to whenever that point is in your life, I think we need to engage positively as a community, hapuri, to refresh, to relook at learning our beautiful reo. Take the opportunity to look at how we can celebrate that as a here in Whangaroa.
Usually, I don't know what usually. Usually a newspaper, newspapers will change their masthead to the Māori version and things like that. The media does a bit.
I'd like to see our library take a lead role in this too, because we have quite a beautiful collection of historical books and reading material for early childhood and beyond. Our library. So take it seriously as a celebration.
It sounds like something the council would do. I just don't know if I've got no clues whether.
Oh, there is money there. I'm not sure who has it.
Libraries. Well, the council has many buckets, many buckets of money. They're not allowed to mix. I know that. I know that much by law, in fact. So.
I'd like to see it used. I don't know if Raglan naturally has funding for such, or whether that's something they'd do.
The only thing, they might. The only thing I know that they're doing is tomorrow, I think, there is a treaty workshop. I'm trying to find.
Oh, yes.
I'm just trying to find the tab. I've got a million tabs open. So, yeah, Understanding the Treaty of Waitangi, 9 o'clock in the town hall. Ingrid Hugens?
Yes.
Facilitator. So that's the only thing I know that tomorrow, that's something Raglan naturally is doing. It's not exactly what you're asking about.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, along those lines, there are many, many aspects to how we can invite the reo into our lives, you know, through my fingers, of course, waiata, singing, becoming, you know, a community who sings bilingually or trilingually or as many languages as you like, but make Māori a priority.
in
that part of
the original language of this land. So,
And there's so much to offer.
And it's what's unique about this country as well.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're I think we embrace it, and I certainly will make some more noise.
Of course.
About that. Now that I'm well again, really well, I'm out. Yeah. Looking for that, what is it that we can come together as a community and celebrate that regard. So,
all right, time for us to wrap up. So thank you for coming in, Aranoa, we'll see you again in 2 weeks, which actually will be Māori Language Week, Te Wiki o Te Reo Māori. So,
maybe we can have more waiata during that week, recommend.
Well, we'll have a talk. We should have a talk now and
okay.
See if we can do something. Yeah. All right.
Ai kia ora.
Thanks for coming in.